I was at Pearl Harbor December 7th. My ship was sunk. And we have a Pearl Harbor Survivors Association that is about to dissolve because the World War II veterans are dying at the rate of 18,000 a day. And most of the Pearl Harbor survivors can't travel anymore, all in their 80s and 90s, like I'm 95. So I've never approved, though, of them calling it Pearl Harbor survivors. There were about 40,000 military people in the area of Oahu on December 7th. A little over 2,000 were killed. So you've got over 38,000 survivors. So I prefer to call them veterans, Pearl Harbor veterans. But there's not too many of us left. When I talk about Pearl Harbor, I always mention that we were at risk for about 3 hours. The real heroes are in Iraq and Afghanistan today, where they're under exposure 3 hours in the morning, in the afternoon, and more. But somehow, Pearl Harbor caught the imagination of the American public and still is interesting, even though it was only a three-hour ordeal for the actual action in it. But unless you've studied history, you don't know how Pearl Harbor fits into the master scheme. So if you'll let me take a little time, I'll feed up to how why Pearl Harbor happened. So the Japanese religion is sun-worshipping. You know, their god is the sun goddess. And the royal family, up until Emperor Hirohito abandoned the throne, claimed they were gods, you know, up until just a few years ago. But somehow this Amaterasu, the Japanese sun god, there's a statue of her in Tokyo. But in their literature, she said there's going to be a day when my island empire will rule the world. Now, since their god was God, it was really an evangelistic crusade. And they felt just like we do about the gospel, you know, we've got to get the world. They had to bring the world under their god. So this dates back 2,500 years ago, where they had a plan to rule the world. Now, they didn't take up on it for a while. 1895, they had war with China. And in the peace terms, got Taiwan, which was called Formosa at that time, and a large a chunk of China, and then Korea. Actually, they took over Korea. 1904 and 5, they had a successful war with Russia and annexed the Russian islands north of Japan and replaced the Russian influence in Manchuria. So they began to expand during this time. So that was quite an expansion to get to Korea, then Manchuria and China. And let's have the next one. In 1910, they annexed Korea. 1917, defeated the Germans in Shantung and possessed German-colonized islands in the Pacific north of the equator. In 1927, the emperor signed a document for a 100-year plan to conquer the world. It was called the Tanaka Memorial. Now, historians sometimes dispute the authenticity of the document, but not the strategy, because this strategy was carried out. And when Emperor Hirohito died, President Bush went to the funeral. And I never did forgive him for that, because this was the guy that signed the document approving the conquest of the world, Emperor Hirohito. Okay, this was the 100-year plan. Phase one, exploit Manchuria for manpower and resources. Japanese have no natural resources, such as rubber, tin, and oil. And they needed manpower. Phase two was to secure what they call the Southern Resources Area, Indonesia, Malaysia, and so forth, for much-needed rubber, tin, and oil. I think slide ahead, there's a map. Maybe see if that's the next one on there. Flip it ahead until we come to a map. Go ahead, Lenore. That's the one. By 1942, you can see this little country about the size of Japan had Korea, Manchuria, a third of China, Indochina, Indonesia, all this area. So that was quite an expansion for them. But the phase two in World War II was to get Dutch East Indies, because it needed the oil, and Malaysia and French Indochina for rubber and ore up there. So that was a 100-year plan. Now, as you look at that map, you can see they had a problem. If they're going to exploit the resources of Indonesia and haul them back to Japan, the U.S. has a strong military presence in the Philippines, biggest merchant marine fleet in the world. And they could not complete as long as we had forces in the Philippines. They knew from their intelligence that our plan for defending the Philippines involves stationing the battleships in certain strategic areas of the Philippines. So I'm jumping ahead here. We'll come back to this. Their whole plan in attack on Pearl Harbor was to neutralize the battleships so they could get on with the invasion of the Philippines, which they needed to make the connecting link. Now back up a little bit on that. Here we are. The third phase of the plan was to build a military machine capable of conquering the world. So in 31, annexed Manchuria, set up a government there. At 39, Hainan Island was in the news a few years back, you remember? That's when this crippled U.S. Navy Air Force intelligence plane landed there. So, but the Japanese took that over in 1939. They set up their own government in China. 1940, signed the Pact of Steel with Germany and Italy. Now, they had a dream plan for the future. And that was that eventually Germany would invade the U.S. through Canada and the Japanese through Mexico. That they didn't get very far along in that was their dream plan. You know, we faced some real enemies back in those days. Okay, 1935 through 38, they captured more of China, and most history books record the horror of Nanking, which 200,000 Chinese were slaughtered in that city. Yeah. I'll hold a little closer, huh? Okay. Thank you. I'll hold it up. If I drop it down, let me know, okay? 39 occupied bases in northern Indochina. Now, the British owned Malaysia and Hong Kong. The Dutch, Indonesia, the French, Indochina. All three of these countries were involved in a major war in Europe with Hitler. So this was the time to strike. So that's the time to go after Indonesia. Okay, let's go for the next one. The League of Nations protested, and so they resigned from the League of Nations in 1940. 1941 occupied all of Indochina, and had completed training and equipping a 200,000-man army in Taiwan with 800 aircraft and 94 troop transports to invade the Philippines. So they were sitting there. The Philippines was their target. Okay? I don't know how that got in there, but my wife and I were married in 41 also. To test our will in December 12, 1937, we had a China fleet over there. China was not a united country, and they leased out various parts to anybody. So we had a fleet in the Yangtze River. So without any provocation, they sunk that ship, the Pan A, to test our will. Well, there were big headlines in the paper. But nobody did anything about it. You know, just so the Japanese knew, well, we can get away with about anything. You know, they will not retaliate, okay? Then in the U.S. canceled a treaty with Japan, which had been in effect since 1911, allowing the sale of scrap iron. Then the next thing that happened, most of the U.S. Pacific Fleet was on the West Coast. So the back in Washington, we're not sure who did this, probably President Roosevelt, said, well, we want to show Japan they need to slow down, so we'll move the fleet from the West Coast to Hawaii. Well, a little bit I'll show you a picture of the harbor. And the military people said, this is a disaster, because Pearl Harbor, it has a narrow neck to get in. You bottle a fleet in there, you know, they'll close the channel, can't do a thing. Admiral Richardson was the commander-in-chief, and after he was ordered to keep the fleet out at Pearl Harbor, he put on civilian clothes, flew back to Washington, met with President Roosevelt, and said, this is not a threat to Japan. They know that to get ready for war, we've got to go back to the West Coast shipyards to take on our wartime allowance of ammunition, take up the teakwood decks, weld up the portholes. You know, we had a peacetime Navy then. So he says this is a dumb move to keep the fleet out there. So Roosevelt fired him. Now, in 1938 or 9, Mini World's Fair was held on in Treasure Island in San Francisco Bay. And the president came out, cut the ribbon. Now, presidents weren't as busy in those days as they are today. So after he had done that, he took a fishing trip down to Panama on a U.S. Navy cruiser, the Houston. And the admiral on the cruiser was named Kimmel. And so they got to be good fishing buddies. So after Richardson protested what he did, he fired him, jumped over all the senior admirals in the Navy, about 40 of them, and appointed his buddy Kimmel as the new commander-in-chief. So he didn't have a lot of acceptance. Now, I don't doubt his professional ability. You know, he should have been in there. But that's the way he got in. So people in the military are not very fond of people that have political influence behind them. So he was the commander-in-chief. Then in 41, Roosevelt cut off all oil exports to Japan and persuaded Indonesia and Great Britain to do the same. Japan only had a 18-month supply of oil at this point. So they desperately needed oil. No, they had to make a move, okay? This was the battleships. Battleships all, when they were in column, were in their order of seniority. The commander-in-chief was in the front one, the Pennsylvania. The commander battle force was on the California. The commander battleship's battle force was on the West Virginia, which was my ship, the third one in this column, that I spent a little over 10 years aboard my life aboard that ship. Okay. Now, things began to get kind of hot between the U.S. and Japan. And the Japanese had the biggest merchant marine fleet in the world, and they could carry U.S. mail. But about a month before Pearl Harbor, the president refused to send mail on Japanese ships. And then just a few weeks later, a few days later, he interned all the Japanese merchant ships, all the Japanese merchant ships inside U.S. ports. Well, you can see it's getting pretty hot. So Roosevelt did the unthinkable. He sent a message to Emperor Hirohito and said, we got to do something about this. We want to go to war. Well, that's like sending a message to God. You know, you don't send a message to the emperor. You send it to the prime minister, the president. So it got through to him. They came back and said, now, we don't want war, and we'll do anything we can to keep from it. And to prove this, we're going to send a peace ambassador to work out our differences. So I was a part of the fleet that was out on patrol. We came into port on Friday night, December 5th. And here Admiral Caruso, who was a peace ambassador, landed in his seaplane on his way to Washington. Now, what we didn't know was that the Japanese fleet was just over the horizon. And he knew that. So the Japanese had done this before, you know, said, we don't want war. So Washington ordered all the ships on patrol to be brought in to port. There were 164 ships in Pearl Harbor, including a small craft and Coast Guard. And I'd just been married for 5 months. I had to wait 2 hours for a bus. There were so many sailors there to get home. The harbor filled with ships and people. Most people ever been in that city at one time, military. But I remember Saturday morning then when Caruso took off for Washington, I thought, well, I hope he's successful. But he knew that the Japanese fleet was just over the horizon. Right now, this is purely to keep us unarmed. Now, this generation can't understand what it's like where you only knew what you saw. There was no radar, no satellites, and the Japanese maintained radio silence. So we didn't know they were out there till they showed up. You know, just the Army had installed a radar in on the island of Oahu. Thank you. I'll try to keep it up. And I think maybe they learned this from the Indians, that they would never attack after sunset. So for some reason, they said, we'll keep the radar turned on we turn it off at sunrise, turn it on at sunset. So sunrise came, and they turned off the radar there. Well, a couple of sergeants were up there, and this was like a big video game, you know. So they had so much fun, they didn't want to go down, so they just kept it turned on. And they picked up the Japanese airplanes coming in from the north. And they phoned their senior officer and told him that, you know, there's a bunch of airplanes out there. He looked at his schedule and he said, well, we've got a flight of B-17s coming in from the West Coast, so it must be them. Well, he needed a little lesson in geography because the B-17s were coming in from the west, the Japanese were coming in from the east, and the Japanese planes were coming in from the northwest up there. Now, with that many ships in port, they generate a lot of garbage. So you've got to do something with it. So every morning a tugboat with some barges behind went around to all the ships and gathered up the garbage. Now we had a submarine net across the neck into Pearl Harbor, but they took the garbage out to sea and dumped it. Well, for them to get through, they had to take off the torpedo, open the submarine net. Well, the Japanese knew this routine. So they had some small submarines waiting outside the harbor. And as soon as they took the torpedo net away, to let the garbage out, they came in and confirmed the location of the ships. Well, as a backup, we had a destroyer on patrol outside. All it did was just go back and forth across the neck of the harbor so nobody could get in. So they got one of these submarines and sunk it. And the captain of the Aaron Ward radioed in to the commandant that he had sunk a submarine. And the officer who took the message said he couldn't believe that. He said, verify. So many things could have happened, to put us on the alert. But the first time we realized there were Japanese planes is when we saw them with the naked eye coming in. Now, the Japanese very cleverly had painted their aircraft olive drab, which was the exact color of our Army Air Force planes. And there were always planes flying around, so nobody paid attention to see airplanes flying around. So the first one that I saw was flying real low and slow, and so slow you could see almost the color of his eyes. And he had a machine gunner, and he banked the plane, and didn't bank quite far enough, so the machine gunner shot right over my head and dug a trench right behind. So the war became kind of personal about that point. Go ahead, let's see the next one here. Here's a summary. Now this is a long version. This is what the Japanese came in with. Six carriers with 360 aircraft, two battleships, and so forth in the task force. And then now Pearl Harbor was one of nine attacks on the morning of December 7th. Unless you're a student of history, you don't know this. You think that Pearl Harbor is just an isolated thing. They actually struck Indonesia down here before they struck Pearl Harbor. Eight here, let's see, it's not on this map, but they hit down here first. And then they hit every base, air base in the Philippines, December 7th. They hit Singapore, Malaya, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Guam, New Guinea. Now, Pearl Harbor was the biggest attack, but they meant business. You know, Pearl Harbor is way over here. Okay, let's see the next one. Okay. So you can see their strategy, which was a good strategy, and that was, we've got to have the Philippines at all costs. So to capture the Philippines, we've got to keep the battleships out of there. Now that was probably an obsolete strategy, but that's what they came for. Now, you've probably watched some of the films, Toro 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 and Pearl Harbor and so forth, and know that the Japanese officer who led the raid was Lieutenant Commander Fushida. He's the guy that was telling the admirals what to do. Well, after the war, he thought he was the only survivor of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And he suffered great remorse about what he had done. So he was writing a book, and it was called No More Pearl Harbor. But how do you tame the primitive instincts in man? You know, how do you prevent Pearl Harbor? Well, about that time, General MacArthur, who was the military governor of Japan, sent for him. And as he got off the train in a Tokyo railway station, a Christian missionary handed him a tract. And interesting story, I'll work this in, it's not in all presentations, that one of General Doolittle's crew members, a man named Joe DeShazer, his B-19, I guess it was shot down. You remember they made an attack on the mainland of China in April of 1942. He was shot down and was a prisoner. So while he was in prison camp, he asked the Japanese for a Bible. And they gave him a Bible. And as a result of reading the New Testament, he became a Christian. So the tract that the missionary gave to Captain Fushida was the account of Joe DeShazer, who went to Bible school, went back to Japan as a missionary. And he said, why would this man that we treated so badly come back as a missionary to Japan? And he said, well, it was the Bible that changed his life. So I think I'll get a Bible. So he asked the missionary for a Bible. And as a result of the Bible, reading the Bible, he became a Christian. He linked up with an ex-Chicago policeman in youth work and traveled extensively in the U.S. And we don't advertise this too much in Colorado, but he stayed overnight at Glen Eyrie, our headquarters, every time he came through. I had some good conversations with him in this. And so out there in Pearl Harbor, we were expecting a second attack, a return attack. And I asked him about that. You know, were we in danger of a follow-up attack? He said, really not. He said, we only had a four-hour window to meet our tankers on the way back. And if we had delayed more than 4 hours, we would have run out of fuel. And he said, beside, my mission was to immobilize the battleships. As soon as I had pictures showing what I'd done to them, I was ready to go home. Mission accomplished, you know. He knew what he was about. Let's see the next one. I've already mentioned this right here. Go ahead. These were the American ships But we don't need those. We go ahead from that. Keep going. You notice in this picture that over at the submarine base is a tank farm. And over here is another tank farm. We had a year's supply of oil. If the Japanese had been intent on doing a lot more damage, they never touched either of those fuel farms. It would have taken us 6 months to replenish the fuel, and they'd settled off. Also, the sub base is right here. The submarines carried the war for the first 2 years. They didn't touch it. On December 6th, we dedicated a new dry dock over here that was big enough to accommodate a carrier. They didn't touch it. Didn't touch the Industrial Navy Yard. The only reason they attacked the air base was so that our airplanes wouldn't follow them back to the ships. So two things, immobilize the battleships and prevent any aircraft pursuing them back. Okay, let's see the next one we've got here. This is a map we got. Whenever a country loses a war, you send in an intelligence team to open all their safes, steal all the documents they can. So this is a Japanese document with English captions on it. Every of the 40 torpedoes were dropped, every pilot had to give an account what he did with his torpedo. So you can see that nine of them were aimed at the West Virginia here. Now, we were next to the Tennessee, and last night you saw the picture of Gus. Dr. Moore was telling us about him, He was leading the Navigator Ministry on the Tennessee. They were undamaged, so between ways, we'd get together and talk there. And there's much fuel oil around, pretty soon it's soaked with that. I didn't want to get in my wristwatch, so I asked Gus if he would hold my watch, so he kept it all day for me there in that. So you saw his picture last night in Steve's presentation. You see, most of the torpedoes were aimed at the West Virginia and the Oklahoma, although they got a couple over here. One of them stuck in the mud here. Some of them that went to the cruisers were set too deep, so they went underneath the cruisers and didn't blow them up. On the other side of Ford Island, they shot at some cruisers. Now, the Utah here was a World War I battleship that had been converted to a radio-controlled target. And it had 8x8s all over the top decks, and the aviators used it as a target and dropped water bombs on it. So apparently some aviator thought this was a carrier. He mistook the 8x8s, for a flight deck and sunk it. So it's still lying on the bottom over there. One of the earliest bombs hit the Arizona, penetrated the outer decks, blew up all the ammunition, and set all the fuel, about a million gallons of fuel oil, on fire. So it took 3 days before the flame went off on that ship. But fortunately, the wind always blows seaward. And so this smoke from the Arizona covered all the battleships. So when the bombers came in to finish them off, get the next one here. This is a Japanese photograph also. This is what the battleships look like coming in from this direction. Okay, the next one. They dropped, in this particular flight, 50 2,000-pound bombs. 48 of them missed their targets. See where they hit in here. Only two hit their targets. Now, that was because of the smoke. They didn't have smart bombs in those days. So they tried to estimate where the ship was, and every one of them was short, either on one side or the other. Now, I'm going to mention this ship in a minute, a tanker with 6 million gallons of aviation gasoline on it. He had partly unloaded his gasoline the night before, but West Virginia was sunk, the Oklahoma capsized, And he was afraid if the Japanese sunk him, you couldn't get the Maryland in, which was here, you know. So he moved the ship over to the submarine base right during the attack. And as I was there looking on, I know what a quart of gasoline will do. So for more than 2 hours, I thought, that thing's going to go up. And I knew what 6 million gallons of gas would do, more than they'd done all time. So it was a very peaceful time for me. And I think what made it peaceful was that I said, Lord, I'm going to be with you in a minute. And then a minute passed, and I want to be with you next minute. No, it passed. Went and be another minute. So for 2.5 hours, that's what I was doing. Now, the Japanese sent in 140 fighter planes with the first wave, and they expected opposition. Only 6 of our fighters got off the ground. 4 of them were shot down. So there were only 2 U.S. fighters that engaged the Japanese that morning. So you had this 140 fighters flying around, had machine guns, light bombs, no target. They were a real nuisance. You know, anything that moved, they shot at after they dropped their light bombs, machine guns. And I kept thinking they were strafing the Neosho, which moved. And that's the reason I said they're going to hit a vulnerable spot pretty soon, minute after minute. But they never did hit a vulnerable spot in it. You know, if they just concentrated on that ship with one light bomb, they'd done more damage than everything they brought in did, but they didn't. What's the next one we've got? That's what the West Virginia looked like in peacetime. That was my home for 10 years till it was sunk. Next one. There we are going under the Brooklyn Bridge. We traveled a lot on that ship, and that's what she looked like after the 9 torpedoes hit. And they hit 2 bombs, hit us with 2 2,000-pound bombs, but both of them were duds. You know, they just broke open, didn't explode. But one of them went through. We had an airplane on turret 3 back here, 120 gallons of gasoline in it, and the bomb went right through the airplane and on down into the turret and drained that gas down into the turret, so all the people in there were cremated in that turret. The bomb didn't explode, but the friction going through the steel set off the gasoline. So that was a real tragic thing. We lost 105 men that morning, 70% of them, or 70 of them below decks, just about 30 above deck on there. This is the picture you probably see published of Pearl Harbor more than any other. The reason is that there was a life photographer out in Pearl Harbor that was photographing a Hawaiian sunrise for the magazine. So he had his cameras all set up overlooking the harbor. So he got a little more he bargained for, you know. But he was able to capture everything that happened on high-grade film. You know, he's professional. The military got a few pictures, but most of them, so this is one that life photographer took. This is the other side of the island. This seemed to be the, I guess this is the Utah that I talked about. Go to the next one. See, this hole right here was 140 feet long that the torpedoes hit. What they did was had some of them that were set deep hit the armor plate. Then they figured the ship would list, and then next year would surface. That would avoid the armor plate and go right in. So that's what they did in that particular compartment. Okay, let's. This is a picture of Pearl Harbor. You see the real narrow channel here, and then there's a huge left to place that 164 ships. But if you can close off this neck, you know they're dead. And it's like we had a submarine net across here, but it was opened up to let the garbage lighter out, so it didn't do any good that morning. Okay, what else have we got? Oh, these pictures are all the air bases they attack. So I have someplace a number of aircraft they destroyed, but not a single aircraft followed them back to the ships. 2 fighters got them down. Our gun crew shot down 28 Japanese planes that morning, but they got away pretty safe, you know, for 360. And only lost 28. Okay, what have we got next here? That's just another picture of where the ships were. There's a big island right in the middle of the harbor, Ford Island, that had a naval air station on it. So you can see again where we were tied up there. Okay, the next one to see. That's the tanker I talked about. You know, that its capacity was 6 million. It was partly empty, but a tanker has a lot of fumes in it. So if it had been hit, you know, it would have been a tremendous explosion with all the fumes in those tanks. What else we got on here? The destroyer Shaw was in a floating dry dock, and they got a direct hit on her. So that's what she looked like when they went up. Let's take the next one there. The battleship Pennsylvania was in dry dock with two destroyers that casting the Downs in front of it. Well, they bombed it, and it didn't destroy the dry dock, but all the fuel oil of these two destroyers in the Pennsylvania came into the dry dock there. Now, the bombing damaged both the destroyers, one of them on the bow and one on the stern. So after they cleaned out the dry dock, they just took a cutting torch and cut them both in two and welded the good front to the good stern of the other one and had made one ship out of it. But the bombing was bad enough. One of them leaned over, the other one was upright. And I walked right past that a little while after it happened.
The ship in the back, the large one.
That's the Pennsylvania, battleship Pennsylvania. Okay, what else we got? I forgot what. Oh, well, we don't need that anymore. That's the bottom of the Oklahoma. You know, you don't want to see the bottom of the ship, just the top. But it immediately capsized. Now, if you've seen the latest Pearl Harbor movie, they've got pictures of men crawling up there trying to get off. That was purely all a fabrication for entertainment. Nobody was crawling on the bottom of the ship. Who would crawl on the bottom of the ship? All they had to do was go down and swim away if they got caught out there. But a lot of people, they lost over 300 that were killed. Well, you're on a ship down below decks and find yourself walking on the ceiling instead of walking on the ceiling instead of the deck. And you wonder what happened. Well, it doesn't take too much to figure it out. You know, the ship's upside down. It wouldn't happen. So they didn't have any lights or anything, but they knew the ship well enough to work their way to the bottom, you know, by going up instead of down. And they got hold of some chipping hammers and began to chip on the, make it much noise. So within a few hours, the Navy Yard came out with cutting torches, cut a hole in the bottom, and they rescued about 300 of them from through the bottom. So the movie Pearl Harbor doesn't show that. It shows some struggling, but that's what actually happened on that, on the Oklahoma. The Arizona, the heat was so intense. This main mast is held up with three big giant steel columns. And every time you look over at it, it leaned a little bit more. You know. So by the next morning, it was completely over. But that's kind of a sad sight. You know, every time you looked at it, it'd be a little more. It took 3 days for the flames to burn out on the Arizona. But our very efficient military ordered a blackout for the night of December 7th. So nobody could show a light or drive a car that night, and we didn't have blackout lights. But the Arizona, you could see it for 200 miles. But we were very careful the Japanese wouldn't know where the island was, you know, on that. Okay, what else have we got here? Yeah, that's another picture of the West Virginia. What a lot of people don't know, I think, is that Pearl Harbor is a shallow harbor, and where these ships were moored was only 40 feet. Well, fully loaded, a battleship draws 36 feet, so they're only 4 feet of water underneath. So the West Virginia is on the bottom, but the main deck is still above water. But everything above the main deck burned on the West Virginia there. We'd been putting paint on it for 20 years, about that thick. It made a good fire. In fact, every major U.S. Navy ship had a British naval observer to tell us what they'd learned in the war. And they told us that if you ever get in a battle, you burn up your own ships from this paint. So we had a program where we had to remove a ton a day. So we'd already started that, you know. But I don't know how many tons of paint were on that thing, you know. It made it look good. Just put another bit of oil-based paint on it. And I put a fire hose on some of it. And you'd put the flame out, move the fire hose, and it'd flame right up again. Okay, what else we got here? Now, that's the map we saw before. Yeah. You know, if anybody's interested in my detailed account, it's on a website. It's on http://westchesterunion.org. It's a big website, and it's got one section of link is stories. So if you click on that link, there's about a dozen of us got stories on there. You can find my name, and I've got two chapters on it about that. So if you're interested in more detail in my personal experience, you can find it on that website. I think that's the way Japan looked like in peacetime before it conquered all those other nations there. Okay, I think that's the last one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, I think you're here because you're interested in maybe more detail than I would think of. So let's take a little time for questions, if you want to do that.
Here. Can you tell us a little bit of more detail about what you did, where you were when the attack began, what you did afterwards?
I'll have to get a little closer to...
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit more detail about where you were when the attack began and what you did afterwards?
Yeah. The navigators had a big ministry in Honolulu, and the couple running a ministry were away for the weekend. I'd just been married 5 months, so my wife and I stood in for them. And so Saturday night we had a meeting of 120 people. And by the way, some of you know who Roy Robertson was. He was at that meeting. That's when he met the navigators, was that night, December 6th. So we met him then. So the next morning, my wife fixed breakfast for about 8 military people that stayed overnight. And just as we sat down to breakfast, we began to hear explosions. Now, this was not unusual because the Army was setting up shore batteries, and they tested them every Sunday morning. So it wasn't anything new to hear explosions Sunday morning. But it was rumored that the German battleship Grass Bay was in the Pacific, and the British had 3 cruisers out there trying to run her down. So my first thought is the British cruisers got her, and in the laws of war, a ship under pursuit can pull into a neutral port and stay 24 hours. But they've either got to go out and fight or be in turn for the duration. So I thought the battleship was coming in, the British were chasing it. But then about that time, an unexploded anti-aircraft shell landed in the backyard and dug a crater about 20 feet across. Well, one of the guys had a Bible study at 8 o'clock. So he left about the time the first bomb dropped. And when he saw it, he turned around, came back to the house, loaded up. So we were on our way down there, and I got back to ship about 20 minutes after the first attack took place. But we lost all power. Ship was on the bottom, bad angle, fuel oil where you couldn't stand upright. You know, skid, try to step. But everything was afire above the waterline. And I got a fire hose from the Tennessee that wasn't suffering any damage, and tried to wash down the ammunition. I knew where the ready ammunition was. So that's what I did. But no matter what you're trying to do, when you see bodies laying around, you wonder, is he dead or wounded? So you have to go over your own feeling. Now, the military had equipped us with a name tag, metal name tag, with a fireproof cord. So it's very easy just to look at a person's name tag and who it was. So my thought was that their parents will never know what happened to them. And so I went around with a fire hose in one hand, and I memorized name tags so I could write their parents and tell them what happened to their sons. Well, I thought that was probably a good idea. So that afternoon, I went over to the hospital. We had several hundred people that were badly burned, and they set up a special burn ward at the hospital. And he had hundreds of guys in suspension you know, just hands and feet sticking up. So I went down with a pad and said, if you will tell me the name and address of your parents, give me their address and dictate a short note, I'll see that they get it. So I spent all afternoon just taking names to send notes. I got a lot of letters back from their parents because I said, now they'll never know what happened to their son, either what I tell them. Most of them died that night, so that their parents did get that letter that I sent to them after that. So that's what I did the rest of the day.
Yeah. Tell the story about the bomb that you saw that you thought was dropped short. About the bomb you saw.
We were talking yesterday at lunch that most of us have never seen a high-level bomber, and we assumed that you got over the target, dropped the bomb, it came straight down. Well, a dive bomber doesn't, but a high-level bomber has to drop his bomb 7 or 8 miles before it gets the target because it continues to travel at its forward speed. So the Japanese had good propaganda, and we said, if we ever get in war, it'll be a short war. They can't do anything. Their equipment's no good. They can't see straight, all these things. So this bomb was dropped over Honolulu, and I was standing next to the man I worked with on the gun turret. He looked, saw the airplane drop the bomb, and he said, yeah, they can't hit a thing. And then we watched the bomb, and it just kept coming closer and closer. And then it looked like it was going to hit our ship, so he crawled under a life jacket locker. He hit the Tennessee next to us. He did get a couple of bomb hits. So after the smoke and the paint chip and everything died down, he crawled out from under the life jacket locker and said, yeah, just like I said, can't hit a thing. But between waves, one of my friends, a non-Christian, came up to me, and he said, Deacon, I just had a tremendous answer to prayer. He said, I got blown over the side after the first torpedoes went off. And I had to swim ashore. And he said, I ran out of breath. I was afraid it was going to sink. He said, I knew it was those cigarettes. So he said, I told God, if you would just give me enough breath to make it to shore, I'll never smoke again. And he said, God did, so I made it. Well, I looked down his arm. I said, what's that between your fingers? He was smoking a cigarette. His vow really didn't last all that long after that. I'll just mention two other things and then more questions. That after a battle like that, the first thing that happens, you look for your friends. Anybody know what happened to him? Anybody happened to him? Everybody's going around asking. So the concussion of the bombs knocked a lot of people unconscious. So the crew, we took all these bodies, out and laid them out on Ford Island. Well, some of the guys weren't dead. They were just, concussion had slowed their brain down. So they'd get up and walk away. So you'd ask about your friend and said, oh, I carried him out, put him on the, laid him out over there. Well, I was in a chow line the next day, and one of the guys that they told me was laid out at Fort Island looked like the back of his head. So I went up to him and had him turn around. Sure enough, it's one of these guys. Well, it's a great surprise to see somebody that was dead. Monday morning, our dispersing officer was really on the job. We lost all of everything we owned. And he said, well, if you make out a sworn pay statement, I can pay you up to date the money you got coming. So we all lined up to sign these sworn statements. I had a good relationship with him. I saw him often. And when I walked in his office, he got up. He turned white. He began to feel my arms. And, he said, am I really glad to see you? Breathing heavy. I said, well, I'm glad to see you, but we never had a ceremony like this before when I came in. And he said, do you know who just walked out here before you came in? I said, no, I didn't pay any attention. Who was he? He said, the chaplain. He told me he had just buried you. Well, there was another man on a ship of the same last name that unfortunately was killed. He had been at his funeral, but Powell, the dispersing officer, thought it was me. So I can imagine the effect of the resurrection came out of him. But the final lesson, spiritual lesson that I learned was I'd read the testimony of a British soldier that was in the evacuation of Dunkirk. You remember that between World War I and II, the French built the Maginot Line that covered the border between Germany and France. They had enough ammunition supplies to last for 3 years. Well, the Germans knew they couldn't go through the Maginot Line, so they went through Belgium and right around the end of it, went into France, just came around the Maginot Line. The British had sent 350,000 troops over to reinforce the French, and they collided with the Germans coming out of through Belgium. And so the British retreated. They were so outnumbered. Well, they got back to the beach at Dunkirk, and it took 3 days for them to evacuate them, get them back to Britain. One of these guys was a Christian, and he said when the Germans were strafing and bombing them all day long, he said, "You can't dodge them." So he organized a soccer tournament, and they had about six soccer fields going, playing soccer between the times they were attacking. But he said, "I had the greatest peace that I've ever had during that time." So I think what he was saying is what I described. Lord, I'm going to be with you in a minute. You know, next minute, well, next minute, I'll be there, and it never happens. So I experienced that same kind of peace. So the lesson I learned out of it was, if a Christian is facing real danger, the presence of God is very real. But if the danger is imaginary, God doesn't waste his time. So I've had some stressful situations, been in a couple more wars after that. But always I knew that if the presence of God was not with me, so I could feel it, I knew there was no danger. So just go ahead, you know. 90% of the things we worry about never happen. So that's probably the reason that I've got the blood pressure of a teenager at age 95. Yeah. I don't worry about anything. If there's any real danger, why, you know, I'll feel the presence of God. Yes?
What rank were you when you retired from the Navy?
I was 03 in the Navy. Lieutenant senior grade. When at Pearl Harbor, I was a first class gunner's mate when that broke out. They immediately promoted me to chief gunner's mate after the attack.
And when you retired, what was your rank again?
That was 03, lieutenant senior grade. I was actually on the list for lieutenant commander, but I retired before I took it. Dawson Trotman had the pressure on me to get out. I turned it down. I saw somebody. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Now, Roy was on the USS Vega, which is a supply ship which is tied up at the submarine base, if you remember the picture. And they probably have one gun on them that maybe never been fired, because a supply ship is not a combat ship. So the Vega wasn't very well equipped. But of the 164 ships in port, 144 were totally undamaged. They did their job. The Tennessee, we were tied up to, fired every round of anti-aircraft mission it had on board. There were 30 destroyers in port. Three were damaged. 27 of them were shooting everything they had in there, you know. So that's kind of generally a conception that isn't true. They came in to get the battleships, and they got the battleships. But out of 164, 144 were not touched that morning.
Jim, what did you do after?
Well, I was signed up for a lot of money, and it was a secret that the West Virginia had been sunk. So I tried to get off the ship, but they wouldn't let me go because of records not being sent in. they thought I'd embezzled the money and disappeared. So I had to stay for the salvage of the ship. So I stayed on it until it was raised in 1943 and came back to the States. So I stayed in Hawaii another year and a half after the attack. Did I see another hand any place?
Did they recover the money?
When the ship was brought up, a safe had disappeared, and there wasn't any trace. So I was exonerated. A year later, they released to the press that the ship had been sunk. But during that time, we couldn't talk about it. You know, we pretended it was still going. In fact, Admiral Nimitz, who was commander-in-chief, signed all his dispatches, headquarters commander-in-chief, USS West Virginia flagship. So the Japanese were supposed to think that the West Virginia was still operational. But they had to set up a command for all the sunken ships that were going to be salvaged, and they had a Squadron 4, I think it was. But the people in the salvage crew nicknamed it Sunkeron 4. But I was a part of that operation, then the salvage operation.
Yeah. Admiral Kimmel was relieved of his command. Was that fair action?
He was relieved, and so was General Short, the senior commanders. But they were never charged with anything. So their families have tried to get the, you know, that thing reversed. So it was a good move propaganda-wise for, the president, I think, to try to place the blame. But as far as the legality or fairness of it, it wasn't. If they did something wrong, they had to charge them with a crime, but they're never charged with any crime. Yes.
How many navigators were lost in sending West Virginia?
Would you read that?
How many navigators were lost on the West Virginia?
I had access to the death certificates of all of them, and I count about 30 of our gang that were somehow involved. And I also went through the list of death certificates to try to identify every one of them that I had witnessed to personally and what the conversation was. So I located maybe 25 that I'd talked to. And in every case, every one of them said, yeah, this is what I want to do, I need to do, but not now. So I hope they had time that morning to reconsider. Yeah.
You said that you saw the master scheme and started talking about the sun god that they worshipped and the leaders. According to Japanese literature, they're supposed to rule the world. Did you close that loop on why you had the master's plan in Pearl Harbor? Did you conclude that?
Yeah, well, what happened, Admiral Yamamoto, who had been to Harvard University, knew a lot about America. After the success at Pearl Harbor, he said we can advance the timetable 50 years. So he put together everything that would float to attack Hawaii as a base to go to California and go directly into the West Coast. So they set their timetable ahead 50 years. And well, the Battle of Midway, which happened in the middle of 1942, all six of their carriers were damaged or sunk, and their fleet was practically destroyed, you know. So they changed their strategy, and their strategy in World War II was to fight a defensive warfare so they could keep the Southern Resources Area in the peace terms. Now, that's what it's all about for them after that. Defensive war, save their equipment for the next phase. But that was a disaster when they advanced their timetable 50 years. Could you hear him, Jack?
Why didn't they invade Hawaii? Why didn't they invade Hawaii instead of just bombing it? Why didn't they invade Hawaii instead of just bombing it?
An invasion is a terrible logistic challenge. Now, it took 2 years with every ship that was available to get enough equipment to Britain to invade Germany. 2 years. To get over there. So to get the equipment to invade and then supply an army is a mighty big, they never even thought of it. You know, it's such a big logistic nightmare. But I guess not many of you were alive then, but we kept wondering, when are we going to invade Germany? You know, month after month, year after year. Well, they were using all that time to build up what they needed in England to support an invasion, which is only 20 miles away. Well, I think the about time for the small group meeting here, isn't it? But
yeah, my wife and I took a tour, went over, and was over there in Hawaii for a wedding of my daughter, but we took a tour, and the tour guide told us some things about Pearl Harbor. He made sure there weren't any Japanese in our group. He said, you know, one of the things we know here is that they didn't hit the power plant. He said it was right over there. He said if they had just dropped one bomb in there, he said it knocked out all the power. But it didn't. They needed that power to rebuild ships and do all this stuff. He said if they had knocked that power plant out, it would have crippled us. Just one bomb is all it had taken. They didn't hit it at all.
One theory is that they wanted to spare that. But they had no intention of coming back to Hawaii for another 50 years. So that theory is not accurate theory.
Yeah.
I've heard that said, you know, the Navy Yard, they wanted to preserve it. They wanted to preserve the oil farm.
Yeah.
But under their strategy, their target was the Philippines and Indonesia.
Yeah.
And 50 years later was Hawaii.
And their only target was the battleship.
Yeah, they knew what they were about. You know, we want to get the Philippines.
Yeah.
They had to have the Philippines. They didn't have to have Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
And they accomplished what they went after.
Yeah.
In your opinion, do you think President Roosevelt knew more than what he led the American people to think he
knew? Well, I've read all the intelligence reports on this. And Harry Reisner, you know, was on 60 Minutes, was with him when he got the news. And he said if he was not surprised, he deserves an Academy Award for his reaction when he heard the news.
Really?
In there. Now, Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, was an assistant secretary of the Navy under Theodore Roosevelt, I guess it was. And the Navy was his pride and joy. And for him to allow deliberately the destruction of the Navy, you know.
You don't think that?
Oh, no, I don't think.
There's been a lot of speculation that.
Yeah, I think he was stupid, but he was patriotic.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, about taking the fleet out there. Admiral Richardson was right.
It was asinine.
Yeah. Yeah. But he fired him instead of taking his advice.
Really?
I hear you. Question. I had when I was in high school, I had a Christian history teacher who loved to talk about World War II. And he says, and I believe it was the Battle of Midway, he said that we were outnumbered. Maybe I've got my battle wrong, but he said it was a big turning point. And he says that a storm destroyed most of the Japanese fleet before the battle ever began. Is that true or not?
Yes, what happened, the surface ships in Midway never saw each other. But we had patrol planes out, and PBY on patrol spotted the Japanese task force with six carriers. And they were getting ready to attack Midway, had their planes on the flight deck, fueled and ready to go. And so it just took one bomb to set the whole thing afire and blow it up. You know, they had all their planes on the flight deck, which was a big mistake on their part. Well, our strategy was to send in the torpedo bombers first, and while the anti-aircraft fire was diverted to them, the dive bombers would come in. But on the way, they didn't have very good navigation those days. They missed each other. So the torpedo planes were about to run out of fuel, so they made a suicide attack. And one of them, Squadron 20, all of them were lost. In fact, there's only one survivor of the all torpedo planes that attacked. But the dive bombers come in without the benefit of the torpedo bombers and bombed and set all these carriers on fire. Then we had enough submarines to get the battleship and the others in there. So No, Japan's only hope in the Pacific was the couriers, and when they lost all six of them.
Was there a storm that part of the fleet, that the Japanese lost part of their fleet before that battle? You ever heard of that?
I'd never heard that.
Okay. That's what he said. He says that nobody ever teaches that in the history books. Whether that's the case or not, I have no idea.
There's many incidents where it looks like divine intervention.
Yeah, that was kind of his point.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I think God does intervene, but not all the time.
Right.
Somebody asked a question once, whose side is God on in war? And he said, God's not on either side.
Right.
He's on the side of Christians on both sides. In that effect. But the Japanese, Midway, that was a disaster, and they knew it, so they withdrew. We'll fight a defensive war, hoping we can keep the southern resources there, which was their target in the first place.
The unconditional surrender policy prolonged the war?
The Japanese had 13 million trained troops on Japan. An invasion would have been a disaster. But the Japanese can't lose face. They've got to win. So the atomic bomb gave them a legitimate reason to surrender, with the Russians attacking him on the backside. So here they had the atomic bomb on one side, the Russians coming on the other, so they surrendered.
My dad was at Pearl Harbor when he got hit.
Yeah.
And he's still alive. He'll be 89 September this year. But he was on a little ship called the Perry. It was a minesweep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the first ones. They fired up. There weren't any officers on board. They fired up and actually got out. So it's kind of interesting.
They just left the harbor and got out.
Yeah, they fired up and got out of there. But it was quite an interesting little deal. And then he got out. I forgot when he got out of the military in, I think, 47. Right after he got off, just a few weeks after he got off, and he'd been on it for years, he was down in the boiler part of it. The thing got hit and blew up, and if he'd just been on it, he'd have been dead. But he said that he'd gotten my mom a Mixmaster mixer and a sweater. And on the Perry, they didn't have any store. It was so small. So he had a nephew, I believe it was on the Oklahoma. So his nephew was storing my mom's Christmas presents. So, of course, it got sunk. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, that's the picture the press never gives, They show the ship's damage, but not the 144
right.
Doing everything right.
Right.
He's very humble, but the place where he stood was blown up. When he got back to it, he would have been dead.
Yeah, that big hole.
Where
the
torpedo hit, that's where he was.
There's some divine intervention. So there's your divine intervention right there.
Yeah, well, I think so, yeah. But there are several instances where the Japanese sent a whole flight of planes to attack a courier, and the cloud came in and stayed there until they ran out of gas and had to leave, then the cloud left. So there's evidence of divine intervention.
Was General Haffenden the one you were talking about at Dunkirk? Haffenden? Because I was in Germany in 69 with Bob Byrd over there. And he came over. He was a British Christian general. And he'd been there, one of the commanding generals at Dunkirk.
Yeah,
and he was
in India. Haffenden was a British general in India. So that wasn't who I was talking about.
He wasn't at Dunkirk.
Well, he might have been. He might have been.
I think
Dunkirk.
He said
probably
he was
there
when they got hit, and that's
yeah.
what he was. He
yeah,
about
I think he probably was.
Clouds and things coming in, and they got out. So.
I hate to say it, I can't find the cover.
I got it in my pocket.
All right, thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thanks for setting it up.
The guy's got good audio, and I gave him a copy of this. They're going to sync it up for you.
Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jerry, I've met you before.
Oh, yeah. Several times.
Yeah.
I was at the Glen. I've heard you speak many times.
Yeah, well, good to see you again.
Yeah, good seeing you. Yeah, I worked out there. I was out at, and I think I got there in the first part of 70.
Yeah, I remember you from out there.
Yeah, I've been around you quite a bit. You used to speak up there. Lots of them used to.
I don't talk about this except on request. My philosophy is that God is ultimately responsible for what's going on to happen today and tomorrow, not what happened 60 years ago. But there's an interest in it, you know, and the person is there. He's got a different perspective.
Sure, sure. That's like my dad. He's kind of interesting. I saw, he doesn't even talk about it, but there's a little newspaper article here.